Packet Pushers.
Welcome to the IP Physics Buzz, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Ed Horley.
And I'm Scott Hoag. On the show, we discuss all things IPv6, strategy, design, deployment, and operations.
And I'm Tom Coffeen. We've spent 20-plus years working with the IPv6 protocol. We run a consulting firm where we get IPv6 working for our customers.
And we're here to share some lessons learned and how to avoid common mistakes. We're glad you joined us. Today, we're going to talk with Rob Sears with NOAA and NWAVE, who is the current chair for the Federal IPv6 Task Force. So, Rob, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me. It's always good to talk with you folks.
Awesome. Well, hey, I think we start off with maybe some good background information just around the Federal V6 Task Force, what it's about, what its function is, maybe a little bit of what your role and some of the other folks' roles are there, so the audience can get a better understanding of sort of where it fits in the ecosystem, as it would.
I'll say I've been in with the task force chair now for, 2 years, going on 3 years. I want to say it's started formulating as far back as the mid-2014-15, but I think it formally came together around 2019. And it initially came together as part of the development of the mandate that we all know and love, M-2107, for the completion of the migration to IPv6. And it was pulled together to help formalize support for agencies that are going to be, you know, moving and migrating to IPv6. So we have OMB, Office of Management Budget, and General Service Administration, DISA, NIST, and NOAA, and myself from NOAA as the chair. We're the main body of the task force. The task force is actually a subgroup, if you will, under the Cloud and Infrastructure Community of Practice, which is sanctioned by the USCIO Council. So these communities of practice, if there's a major initiative within the federal government that needs additional support or guidance to see it through, the USCIO Council will sanction these communities of practice. And I don't have the exact date, but it's been a long time ago they formulated the data center consolidation mandate to start having the federal government consolidate data centers and not just have willy-nilly data centers everywhere, right? Every agency with their own. So there's this big effort to really modernize, consolidate, turn down. And that was really successful. You know, another mandate that came out circa 2010-11 was the trusted internet connection mandate, that all federal agencies had to be routing through a trusted internet connection, reducing the total number of internet connections that the federal government, or at least the civilian federal government, had to the internet. So that also had some committees around it. So you had trusted internet, you have the data center, and as data center got its legs and really a lot of good effort and there was consolidation, migrated that to infrastructure and cloud, because that's the newer thing. So right, that's a sanctioned community of practice, and under that is where the IPv6 task force sits, and our group is there to aid federal agencies in that migration to moving fully to IPv6. That's kind of the roots, the history. The previous chair was Ron Butcher. I think you guys know he was Department of Justice CTO, now with HPE, and he talked me into it, if you will, to continue to carrying the torch. And I, myself, in our NWAVE, within NOAA, National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, I'm the director of a program called NWAVE, and we're actually a service provider network. We built our own network. It's a government network. So I have to also migrate to IPv6. So it's not as a big of a lift for me to be the chair for something that I'm also doing directly with my team. So I think that's a benefit maybe that I bring as being part of the overall civilian workforce that's actually boots on the ground doing the IPv6 migration.
That's a good background of where things fit and sort of what the task force is up to, right? Because any agency in the U.S. federal government can participate with the task force in terms of getting guidance and interacting, and you guys try and provide forums and resources for all those folks to sort of work together, right? So you don't have to relearn everything for every single organization, right? Hopefully they can learn from each other, maybe reduce the tax burden.
yeah, there you go.
In terms of how that plays out, which would be a positive thing. That's very cool. And like you said, having practical experience of actually working on a real V6 network that has to be at a service provider scale is super important, because, you know, for other organizations to really understand what needs to happen, it's a much more complex sort of task and process. And maybe people look at it, you know, on the initial face of like, oh, well, it's just something that the network team has to worry about. It's like, maybe not so much. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more folks that need to be involved.
Exactly. And with the breadth of IPv6, yeah, that is, I think, what really requires us to formulate a task force to help and provide this guidance. Because I hearken back to the TICAP. That was very specific. That was routing. That was a lot at the network level. We had customers or programs within NOAA come to us and say, okay, I need to route through Denver. I need to route through DC. I need to wherever those trusted gateways were. So it was a lot on the network team, and it could be one group. So there wasn't a full OMB task force that got pulled together. But when you talk about V6 touching so many things, network, application, infrastructure, IoT, yeah, it really then it requires some formal body that can be a point of resource, a point of authority, if you will, a way to coordinate across government and answer questions. I mean, we can't do it for them, and that's the thing, right? I tell NOAA, the NOAA leadership, it's NWAVE, our program cannot do V6 for you, because each of the individual systems, you know, they have their own stuff, and I'm a network provider, so I could do the network side, and yes, I will hand off a routed V6 interface to you, but if you're not ready to accept it, then I can't come in and turn the knob. So,
right.
Yeah, so you need that assistance. And everybody's agencies that are different levels of competency. And then you have the small agencies, what we call the non-CFO Act agencies that really can, these type of mandates can really hit them hard, because many times they don't have like a full CIO, or if they do, it's the CIO is also the CFO is also a, you name it.
Covering all the roles as it would be.
Exactly.
And some of them have very small staff, or they have contracted staff, which is not mm-hmm. uncommon that it seems to be. And so that contracted staff may not have experience or had any exposure to IPv6. And suddenly they're sitting there deer in headlights, and they're like, who do I go talk to? How do I figure this out? How do I participate to be able to learn what I need to do in order to be able to fulfill this OMB mandate, right? I think there's a lot of that, of just like, holy smokes, how do I get technical skills to be able to do the things that are being asked of me?
Great. Yeah, exactly.
Are there particular sort of themes around IPv6 that, I mean, there are obviously with the deployment, there's lots of complexity potentially, and especially with agency enterprises rather that have like different collections of, you know, like legacy software, newer stuff that's more commercial off the shelf, you know, varying degrees of being up to date on tech refresh. But among all those various issues, are there ones that sort of bubble up to the surface consistently that you've seen across agencies?
Yeah, I think the ones that I've seen that are the problem areas, and a lot of it comes at questions in the form of, what does it mean to be fully V6, or what do I count? Because the guidance talks about IT assets, and that IT assets within a FISMA system, a Federal Information Management Security System. And so those physical assets, that government furnished equipment, whether it's physical or virtual, anything that's got a IP interface that can route is included. So you start to see a lot of the legacy systems become problematic. In NOAA, there's satellite to ground stations. They are, a lot of have still have analog type of infrastructure. Storage systems have come up a lot. Applications in some of the agencies. There's homegrown applications that sometimes have hard-coded IP addresses. Subscriptions. That was one of the things we found out as well too. Like library subscriptions. Some vendors use the IP address as the way to do access control for a subscription. So a lot of this legacy stuff kind of starts to boil up. Now, it is not the largest portion of it. There's definitely the legacy, but when we look back at the original IPv6 mandates that rolled out, and not so much mandates, but the original, like FAR and the Federal Acquisition Regulation, I think it was 2009, that said you must make sure you're buying IPv6 capable IT. So that's been in place for a long time. The first round of route, or of making sure public facing assets can route and answer V6, that's, you know, that was a while back as well. So where we're at now, decade later, from some of these original federal initiatives, we're actually in a lot better shape. And it's just coming down to, I think, the internal homegrown specialized apps, specialized systems that are the more problematic. But it's modern OSs, modern networking devices all seem to be very capable. And then it's just looking at that, you know, that end to end within the system, all the dependencies, you know, your logging systems, your patching, your scanning. And I know that can be overwhelming, but when you go through that analysis and start to compartmentalize what functions each of these different systems have and what their capabilities are, it's a lot easier to kind of grasp this than looking at your whole environment once and be going, oh, I just can't figure out how to do this.
That makes sense. And I imagine as they try to work their way through a bunch of these things, they're probably looking for design patterns, architectures, right? Reference materials, either from the vendors, like they're probably asking the vendors first, or like they're probably going to Cisco and asking Cisco something, or they're going to Microsoft, or they're going to whomever they have as a vendor that they're utilizing. They're probably going and asking questions around like, how do I get from point A to point B? And have you built a reference architecture around this? I think there's a lot of struggle in the industry overall about that part of it. And you guys, I know, have started to put together resources to try and help with some of that, because having 50 agencies go ask one vendor over and over and over again for the same thing, probably not super efficient. Maybe it's good from efficiency of like lots of people asking, but
yeah, right. Keep counting them,
but maybe not so much from actually getting a paper out that tell them how to work with you.
Yeah. At some point you got to be like, okay, we'll fix this.
It gives the vendors a real opportunity to perfect their song and dance around what V6 that they should be supporting and they aren't.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about how, if we have government employees or trying to figure out the V6 stuff and they're listening to the show right now, like how do they engage? How do they work with yourself? How do they find resources? How should they be thinking about the problem space overall to engage, and what the role the task force can help?
Yeah, definitely. So the Federal IPv6 Task Force does have a website. It was a max.gov. I believe that is now a different system, so I'll probably have to get those URLs. But we do meet, I'd say, once every, our cadence used to be once a month, but we didn't want to have meetings just to have meetings. So we meet about once every 5 to 6 weeks where we do an intra-agency task force meeting. So that's all federal government agencies, DOD, and the contractors that support the government. It's not industry as far as, you know, your big providers and that. So that's very closed.
Right.
There we do presentations. We try to highlight agency success stories. Actually, the last one we did in February, we talked about BGP routing security because it's IP. So IPv6 does have a role there. So, and actually there was an attack not that long ago, I think it was last year, on IPv6 because they know the federal government's moving, and there's some, I think, out there in the community that a lot of folks, they're not securing IPv6 as they should when you're doing, as you do with V4. So that was an attack on BGP IPv6. So we talked about that, but really the task force is there to pull together resources. And we do have, again, the website, there's a listserv for an email group that a lot of Q&A comes across that, as well as we do annual summits, and we do have one coming up in June. We'll pull that together, and that's a little bit more open. We do invite industry at that point to come in, and especially if there's a topic that we hear from the community that they really want to hear. So cloud routing, V6 has been a big one, you know, specific apps.
Zero trust is another big one.
100%. And that was very interesting when the zero trust initiatives came out through cybersecurity. It came as probably at the middle, it was 2021, 2022, when we were well into the first milestones of the IPv6 mandate. And we had a lot of agencies say, well, what do we do first? Which one takes priority? So we had to really be like, look, they're synergistic. When you're looking at zero trust, you should look at them together. IPv6 is an enabler of that. You know, if you could have unique IP addresses for all your devices, you're not NATing. I mean, you get into all these security benefits. So don't do them exclusively, because then you're going to have to do it again. You roll out a zero trust solution, be like, I'm done. Oh, well, it didn't support IPv6. So that's another thing we try to go with the task force to say, look, when you're doing procurements, make sure that language is in the procurement, that there's V6 support is in there, whether it's IT labor, product, have that as a normal part of your acquisition cycle for IT. and make sure that yeah that's understood. So really that's what we're here to do as the task force. And I gotta find the new link of where the MaxGov site went to.
We'll drop them in the show notes when we do after the show. So that's fine. And this comes back to the case of your peanut butter and my chocolate go better together sort of thing. So I think that's the case for many of these efforts. What I see in the industry overall, and like your thoughts around it, is like, we tell folks all the time, like V6 deployment, that should be part of your automation story, right? Like you should be using automation to deploy V6. So you want to get there better, faster, and more efficiently with better security. Automation becomes a tooling around how you do zero trust and also how you do IPv6, and you can do both of those better together, and you can do it incrementally with something like automation. So it dovetails all together. The same thing around like doing logical refreshes. Like, don't think you're going to do a greenfield V6 deployment, right? And buy all new gear. Very few people get the opportunity to do that, right? So it's matching it in with your LAN upgrade and refresh cycle, matching it in with your WAN and your router and your SD-WAN and your firewalls, and like, what's your regular upgrade and cadence? And so to your point with for the procurement, them knowing that up front, don't let anyone through the front door that doesn't have the right qualifications to be able to participate and do that. Now that gets back to, you have to do enough due diligence to know how to write an appropriate request to get those things. And I think that's where the task force has been trying to help out too, is to try and say like, hey, these are the resources to try and figure out how you need to write these things so that you're not asked for something that is actually doable within a framework of V6, V6 only, and how you get from point A to point B, right? Is having those conversations in a public forum to say like, yeah, what you're asking for doesn't make a lot of sense because what you're trying to accomplish, right, is one set of goals, but what you're actually asking for, it looks different, right? So let's get them aligned.
Yeah, you can't just be like, all right, task one, do V6. <laughs> <laughs> You have to really kind of dig in. And a lot of it goes back to the mandate. And because in the beginning, it shouldn't have caught the private sector community off guard, because it's definitely been around for a long time. But when it got to, you know, hey, we're making this serious transition and we're going to be moving, you know, 20%, 50%, 80% of assets over the next 3 years up to 2025. Then, you know, ears started to perk up. So a lot of the questions in the beginning were, well, really, what does it mean? You know, what does it mean to, you know, V6 only? And so we had to do a lot of Q&A with vendors and mainly a lot with the cloud providers. It doesn't mean that AWS needs to change their entire backend infrastructure to V6. You know, it's
right. Yeah,
you gotta support the government. You just gotta enable us to route V6, to answer V6 when we have, you know, public calls coming in. So you know, a lot of some education in that, and then the same kind of things happen too. It's within the federal side. Is, well, what does it really mean to be fully V6? And you know, the goal is deprecation of V4. We want to move fully. We want, that's the IPv6, that's our version, that's the next generation of IP, and we need to be on that. Government's going to continue to grow. IoT's huge. You know, got sensor networks, you got SCADA systems, you got all this stuff in data centers, and to do it right, especially coupled with zero trust, it's really nice when you have a unique IP for every single device that's on your network, and you can do other creative things as well when you have infinitesimal amount of space.
Yeah, you can do per application session IP addresses, just discard it and never reuse it again, right? So
yeah,
I talk about that, you know, like, let's say you have a single slash 64 and you want to use 10 million addresses a second, never reuse it. It's still going to take you 58,000 years to burn through your address. Your data center is not going to be here in 58,000 years. So the likelihood that you can consume that many addresses in your data center is probably, you know, pretty small. So there's a lot of opportunity. I think that's the opportunity side you're talking about, of doing new innovative things with Kubernetes, with application space, all those sorts of things that really can change how we think about security and posturing. I think Scott talks about, like, he's talked about in the past, like applications that literally only bring up an address based off of like a session instantiation for only talking to one other device. Like, it's a single to single session connection and it builds an address specifically for that connection, then just tears it down and never reuses it again, right? And says, this is that same sort of concept of being able to reuse it that way. And like financial trading, there's all sorts of interesting things that could go on. And so for the federal government to have that much flexibility in terms of potential service offerings and how they interact with their constituents and with the services they have to provide, I think that becomes a very unique opportunity, especially for agencies that may have to do very large scale. I mean, technically we could assign a V6 address for every single tree that's growing in the forest.
Yeah.
If that was needed, I don't know if it's needed, but hey, maybe. There's interesting things that could definitely happen there. So it's pretty cool to see the federal government pushing to basically, you know, sort of make their capabilities better for their citizens overall, which is, you know, the end result. That's really what this is all about, right?
100%. And I like that stance. It should be looked at as a technical modernization, innovation opportunity. And not just, you know, a readdressing a practice. It's like, where can we go? I know Doug Montgomery at NIST, like, say, you know, what do you do when IP space is no longer an issue? You know, if you think about it that way, it's, well, you don't have to worry about not having enough space. You don't have to worry about NAT anymore. What can you really do? And I really like that, you know, application level communication, you know, from the security perspective, the being able to do, like you said, to have a one-time transaction, it's done. Just a lot of really big possibilities. And that's where the government should be looking at, is innovation and how we can take these opportunities and not just see them as a, you know, administrative process, but an enabling process. And I know a few folks in our space too, that do some cool things, like, you know, with the IP space and being able to code in like room numbers or IDF spaces, because you got the, you know, the new, the characters now in the way the IPv6 bits are. So all sorts of cool stuff, and it should be looked at as an opportunity. It's just, I know it's an effort, right? People see this, wow. Well, and we hear a lot of that. Well, why now? And why do we, you know, why do we have to do this? And why is it now? It's like, well, I know we're really late.
Well, hello, listener. You know, getting into the cloud is easy. It's what happens once you're there where things get interesting. On the Day 2 Cloud podcast, hosts Ned Bellavance, that's me, and Kyler Middleton explore the nitty-gritty of cloud operations, from tooling and automation, to resilience and security, to visibility and cost management, and so much more. We talk with technical leaders, practitioners, trainers, and consultants on all aspects of cloud operations to equip you, yes, you, with the information you need to address technical and business challenges in the cloud. So whether you're public, private, hybrid, or multi-cloud, let Day 2 Cloud be your guide. Listen at packetpushers.net or wherever you get your podcasts.
And I think this is also a competitive thing about how competitive does the U.S. want to be on an international basis, on an international footprint. China has been very aggressive around their adoption of V6 and has federal mandates requirements. So Vietnam just recently announced on their side, they didn't make it a mandate just for the federal government side of Vietnam. They said everyone in Vietnam is like 80% adoption by like 2026 or 27 or something like that. It was like, holy smokes, they're moving, and they're doing it because they see strategic business advantage and market advantage for what they can do and what they can provide. And I think the U.S. needs to wake up a little bit to realize that this is going to be a big competitive issue going forward for their footprint. I mean, India has remarkable IPv6 adoption in the country for a whole variety of reasons. And the Asia Pacific region was sort of starved out of IPv4 in many ways, just due to history around sort of allocations and what went on. And so their adoption of V6 is out of necessity. So in some ways, they're getting better practice than we are in that particular area. And I think there are many folks that need to wake up to realize that we're falling behind a little bit in the technology curve, or being able to have this in our wheelhouse and be very competent and good at it.
Yeah, you mentioned being able to unlock, you know, innovation and business value with V6. You know, that's certainly an option. And I think, you know, just sort of circling back to my initial question to Rob, which is, you know, what are some of the common themes that agencies with challenges that they run into related to their IPv6 efforts? And I think one of the things that we've seen is a lot of agencies kind of saddled themselves with an allocation from, you know, 10 plus years ago, where they're not necessarily thinking, is this enough address space to not just keep the existing network up and running and keep everything functioning as it exists today, but to potentially unlock innovation in the future and meet all of the additional technology mandates that are coming down the pike to keep the government agencies, you know, competitive. The idea that, you know, as you say, it's like if you take a single 64, there's more than enough address space to do, you know, literally anything, but that's not the same thing as having enough prefix space, you know, to basically lay out the network in a logical way and in a way that's completely future-proof with innovation-wise, whatever might come down the pike. And of course, you know, there's always the possibility of getting more address space. But I think, you know, if you're in an agency and you're like, well, we have this V6 allocation, it should be enough. And it, you know, from an address standpoint, it certainly is. But from a prefix standpoint, maybe it's not really as large as it could be to you know, unlock innovation in the future. And so I think that's maybe a theme that we're seeing, and that, you know, hopefully is getting corrected over time as agencies figure out, it's like, oh, we're going to get more space. We're going to start with more space to have and to use and really move in a better direction.
Yeah, I agree. And I think when the first allocations came out at the agency level, I want to say it was back in like 2006, if I recall, and the agencies received the space and they kind of sub-allocated from there. And I know we were still in the same mindset of V4 subnetting, and we weren't really thinking about these things like the innovation side and really new ways to do that. And we actually, and then you guys and Tom helped get EndWave the larger space. I think it was the /18?
/20, I think, yeah.
Or the /20, yeah. And as of 2006, we weren't a government service provider. And even though probably we could have, like, from the pure numbers of the original allocation, yeah, we could have been able to address everything. But really taking a step back, redoing our IPv6 address planning that was not based on like a campus and a location and a division, but looking at functional kind of areas of, like, you know, our management network, and then cloud, and then customer specific allocations. And just, it's really taking that holistic look and trying to be as forward thinking as possible, and then keeping a section for mistakes, right? if you didn't quite do it right, you know, you still have that extra space. But I think that's what makes it somewhat time kind of daunting, because you do have to have a little bit more visionary look, if you will, about when you're coming in to tackle this, if you really want to take advantage of it, and not just seeing it as a, I gotta change this address IP number to this one now. It's definitely much more than that. And I do want to try to keep pushing that through the task force, is, again, the opportunities, the innovation, what can you really do beyond just changing an interface address? What are some of the good things? And you mentioned automation. That's something that we did when in our program, you know, we spent a lot of time in the lab testing our tools, because as a network provider, it's most of all of our infrastructure is network hardware. So how we manage that, we wanted to move it to V6. So we spent a lot of time with our, you know, our logging tools, our AAA, all the things that touch the network devices from a management perspective, tested everything, and then took a few devices, made them V6 only, watched them. And then at that point, through Ansible, we use for a lot of our automation, rolled it out, started rolling out the management interfaces V6 only. And at that point, the numbers grew. I think we're about 40% complete within our organization of about 2,000 devices. It's taking that time, again, good testing, and then finding that point of that next jump when it's like, okay, now we got this. Now we can make the big leaps. But I'm, again, a little easier for us because I don't have a lot of applications or a lot of end devices other than, you know, engineers with laptops. So maybe easier for my program, but I am in the thick of it and definitely want to help where I can to the other agencies to show that it can happen. You can make big movements and you can compartmentalize, you know, the low-hanging fruit, work over here. If you know the legacy system can't go, don't dwell on that. Let's keep it on the side, but keep making progress. It's all about making progress. We're not going back. It's all about forward.
Well, and, yeah. And I think the mandate does recognize there's a reason they only carved out for 80% at the end, because they realize you're probably going to have to run, you know, IPv4 as a service and run certain things as IPv4 over the top of your IPv6 network to service those old legacy applications. Or, you know, in the case of certain agencies and groups, like, they got ancient medical devices that are never going to support V6, or you got ancient IoT devices that are never going to support V6. You have to do something with them. But having the flexibility in your and modernizing your network architecture to be able to support IPv4, you know, dual stack, IPv6 only, and being able to transition back and forth between those and having the right translation technologies to accommodate everything you can do there, you can come up with a strategy to get the majority of your end client devices, which is probably for most organizations the bulk of what they need to do, moved over. I agree with you from your strategy basis of sort of talking through the big problem spaces for other agencies. Maybe we take this as an opportunity to sort of pivot a little bit and look at the bigger picture, which is, you know, one of the things the task force I know regularly sort of reports on is everyone's progress. Right. Mm-hmm. And what does that look like? And maybe I ask you, are you happy with progress? Are you frustrated? What are you seeing that are the gaps that folks are dealing with? And are people doing the right thing in terms of directionally what's going on? Like, maybe get us a little bit of a feel for that.
I think the numbers on paper, I guess I'm not happy with as far as just what gets reported. It's a little bit hard because we do it through this DHS FISMA quarterly report where each agency reports their numbers, and the FISMA quarterly has been something that's been in play for a long time. And you report your IT assets that are V4 only, dual stack, and V6. And I know it can be frustrating because you could be dual stack for a long time and you want to get points for dual stack, but it's really all about, you know, that V6 only number. So on paper, the agency progress is slow when you're looking at the graphs, and you're like, that's a little frustrating. What's optimistic and what really I think is the silver lining is when we talk to agencies and we hear about the progress and we hear about the effort, maybe the numbers aren't quite there, but it's not, we can't do this. We're not, you know, there's just no resources. Folks are actually digging in and say, okay, yes, we have more plans. We've had more testing going on in labs. We're tackling this application first, and there's effort. And I think that's the big thing is, again, that forward progression there, that there's effort being made. It's not just, well, we just can't do this. That's not an option. And when you're reporting as an agency, you don't want to have nothing to back the low numbers. When you could back it with, well, here's a project plan, and we're really going to tackle it this specific way. We're end devices, these laptops first, and there's this one application, though. Once we get that, then it's going to really tip the scale. So that's where I'm really happy to see is that a lot of agencies are making that progress on the actions to get there, and the numbers, I think, will come. Just kind of like our situation where we spent almost 8 months in dual stacking testing before we finally flipped that bit to V6 only, and then now our numbers are increasing. So I think we're going to see that again. It's and I can't speak for every agency because I don't do one-on-one with each, but the majority of folks we do talk to that come out to events, and that everybody's taking it seriously. Everyone's trying to do their best as far as how to work within their system, and that's encouraging. And on the same point, I think it's encouraging to see the private sector as well making those commitments more and more. When we first started, a lot of questions came into the committee, the task force, about, well, what does this really mean, or what about this area? Kind of like you could feel the pushback. And now I think there's more and more vendors that they're seeing it, and they're putting in the effort. They're putting money into the development. We're seeing cloud providers, a lot of the network providers. So that's really good to see as well. And I'm optimistic that folks will continue. We do Birds of a Feathers at Supercomputing. We have over the past 2 years have done a BOF with IPv6 at Supercomputing. So we try to bring in the big network vendors and HPC, trying to tie HPC into this as well. And they've turned out really well. We've had a mixed group of international science, research, education community, and providers in the room, understanding the benefit and sharing in the challenges. And then, of course, that's for some, and I think, like you mentioned, with the resource depletion it's addressing, it's like real estate, right? In California, or you name it, there's no more land. You got to build smart, you got to build up. And if you want to be a viable government agency with global collaboration, or a private sector or company, it's just inevitable. You have to do that. You have to make that migration.
Right. In California, it's no more water.
Yeah. Same here. Same in Nevada. It has to water.
Yeah, exactly. I guess maybe the thing that's sort of interesting is, and to your point, is once you figure out the first laptop, all the other laptops can move over, but you still got to get that first laptop figured out, right? That first application stack, everything that's going on that device, which it takes a lot of time and effort. And depending on how complex your environment is and how many apps you're running and what you're doing with that particular platform device and how you're managing them, all those things have to be looked at. So the agencies that are taking their time to really figure that out, it just takes time to figure it out. I mean, there's no other way around it. And so once they do, and they do get the strategy done, then I think things will move relatively quickly.
Yeah, I agree. And I think if agencies are documenting that progress and you have that artifact that says, look, here's what we're doing, here's our plan, here's that, that application, whatever it may be. Not saying that there's going to be a more scrutinizing eye, but if there happened to be at some point in the future, if the numbers aren't pleasing, then you have the data behind it. And it's like, oh, okay, well, yeah, we see, and this effort at some point is going to propel those numbers. So, it's like show your work kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Show your work as you're progressing through. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I flip it on you. Are you frustrated with any particular things that you're seeing in terms of lack of on the industry side? We don't have to call anyone out here, but, are there things from a frustration standpoint that you get to see because you get the bigger picture sort of across the board of getting a chance to talk with so many folks and sort of see what's happening
from a private sector vendor community? I don't think I've run into anybody that's just flat out said, nah, we're not doing it. So I guess that's good. I have seen a few in kind of the SD-WAN side that were lacking or lagging and that they need to catch up. I do think that the concept or the understanding of global collaboration really needs to be more absorbed, at least from the federal community, that's going to be key. And then I think some of the private sector resources, SaaS applications that a lot of agencies use that need to also kind of, step it up and make sure that they can answer, in Route V6. And there's so many different software application, cloud-based software applications that are out there. And I know that that's hard, but if the government's using it, you really need to think about making sure that it could at least respond and answer up to a V6 inquiry. So that's where I think I get a little bit frustrated. And then I think also just in general, that's the benefit doesn't seep in because it's not something like that's like, oh, this is going to save you X amount of dollars year one. That's the big thing, I think, as well, is you got to put a lot of resources and effort into it. And if you have a huge product line and you have, your X network vendor and you have applications that manage, you have software and management infrastructures, not just your network devices, but security products and all that, I could see that it gets daunting because you have to test end to end all those things. And then also, I guess, some of the experience of tier one services when you call in for support on V6, a lot of times that is not as mature, if it may be even lacking wholly, that you would get from calling in and it's a V4 related type service. So yeah, that tier one help desk function at your major providers may be lacking as well.
Yeah. Those are all good points. I think I would agree with all of those that we feel very similar in terms of the frustration side. But let's talk about how folks can get help from the task force. Let's leave on a high note. How would you like folks to interface or interact with you all, their federal employees? They're like, how do I understand the importance of V6 migration? How do I understand what I should be doing? How do I get engaged and start participating so that we can get this done?
Sure. Well, you can call my cell directly. No, just kidding. Don't do that. First and foremost, join the listserv. So I'll have all this information for you to add. We have, a listserv where you could join. You can get the emails. You could ask questions. There's a lot of great comments that go on in there. Folks will just post, hey, has anybody seen this? I'm having trouble with NAT64, DNS64, whatever it may be. And these questions go in there and we let the community answer. I don't step in unless it stagnates or it's something that goes unanswered. A lot of times the community will just answer for you. Now, that's a good place for AI because it'd be nice to scrape all that stuff because it just, emails everywhere. And that's a hard part too, is gathering that information to be cataloged. And that's something that I will admit that the task force doesn't quite have all the resources to do that, but at least with the listserv, you can go back and search email on that. But that's a good first start. And then we have the federal task force website. We do have a lot of resources there, some of the planning documents. And I know some of you guys helped with our initial, it was a primer or at least a kind of getting started IPv6 transition documentation. And that's still out there. That had a lot to do with, the planning phases. There was an assessment template that we put together that some folks at ESNet, DOE helped us with and some other agencies to also help with documenting your assets and putting them in those buckets. Again, capable, not capable applications. So those are on the website. And then joining the every 2 month meetings and the summits. And if folks want to, through the listserv email, and if there's a very specific topic and they think the wider community would like to hear from it, we can pull that together and have that topic at one of our interagency meetings. Again, we've done it a few times where we've had a, you know, AWS or Azure come in and speak to a specific area that might have been a common question. And then I like to be on the road. I'm going to be at Cisco Live in June. We're going to have a federal kind of IPv6 discussion day. So for folks that are out at Cisco Live, come by to do that. And yeah, there's a lot of different places we're at, and it's just all about trying to get that information out. And it's hard sometimes if trying to get that blast. I'm glad that you guys are doing this podcast, because another avenue to get the information out there.
That's awesome. Well, hey, it was great talking with you, Rob. I really appreciate it. And learning all about the current status of sort of V6 migration, U.S. federal government efforts was really super useful. So thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
Yeah, definitely. It's always great to talk to you. And I'm sure we'll be working together over the next years, at least the rest of my career, moving people to IPv6.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of IPv6 Buzz. If you've got feedback or a follow-up on this topic, send us a message at packetpushers.net/FU. We'd love to hear from you and continue the conversation.
Also, on packetpushers.net, you'll find a range of deep dive technical podcasts for IT pros, including Heavy Networking, Heavy Wireless, and Day 2 Cloud.
There's a whole lot more on the Packet Pushers site as well, such as tutorial videos and a networking job board to help you find or fill your next great role. So whether you're deep in your career or just starting up, Packet Pushers is the place to go to grow both your skills and your personal network.
So long, and until next time, we'll see you on the IPv6 internet.